That's the summary of what we're going to hear this morning. Text 48. O Supreme Lord, you are actually the air, the earth, fire, sky, and water. You are the objects of sense perception, such as the life airs, the five senses, the mind, consciousness, and false ego. Indeed, you are everything, subtle and gross, the material elements and anything expressed, either by words or by the mind, are nothing but you, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. This is the absolute oneness feature of the Supreme Lord. Now, if one takes this, if that's it, then you're left with two alternatives. One alternative is you can become a pantheist. Now, a pantheist, literally, you look it up in the dictionary, and you'll find the pantheist is one who sees God in nature. But that's been presented in the modern sense as demigod worship, because each element of nature has a presiding deity. So then one worships presiding deities. And such a multi-worshipper is a pantheist. Pantheism. Many gods. And that's what most of the world is taught. In fact, I've mentioned this before, but when students in America take a world religion course in high school or in college, and they study Hinduism, that's what they learn. Hinduism teaches pantheism. But that's not all of what the Vedic scriptures, or those who are followers of Vedic scriptures, understand. And the basis of that idea of pantheism behind the deity worship is the philosophical understanding of Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma found in the Upanishads and the Vedanta and the sutras, Brahma sutras. Brahman is the basis of all those things, the deities and the elements that they're presiding over. Brahman is the basis. And therefore, ultimately, the other alternative of this idea is monism. Actually, you don't need to worship the deities, or you can worship the deities, the devatas, but really what's important is the high-grade activity of study of Vedanta and the Upanishads, and, you know, the four Vedas. Because then you'll come to know Brahman, which is Jnana process, which Prahlad has already looked at in text 46. And what is the fruit of that? That's what we reviewed this morning. Now, there are several places in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna addresses this very issue in his discussion with Arjuna. And one of them is found in chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 9, text 4. Does anybody know the shloka? It starts, Maya. Translation, essence. It's a short one. Yeah, that's the first part. Maybe you could say it a little louder so they can hear you in the back.
By me, my unmanifested form, I'm pervading the universe.
By me, my unmanifested form, avyakta murti, I'm pervading everything, but
I'm nothing.
But I have my separate existence. This is the oneness, but separateness. This is a chintya, bade, abhed tattva. It's right in Bhagavad Gita. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a chintya veda veda tattva. That's right there. Chapter 9, text 4. It's in those first three verses. First 9, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's reviewed, especially in this text 4. So there's the oneness. He pervades everything. The subtle, the fire is within the wood. The cause is within. There is the gross manifestation of the cause, the effect. The avyakta murti, Krishna pervades all things. He is personally there within all things, but matsthani sarvabhutani na chaham teshu avastita, but I maintain my separate existence. Just like Prahlad is speaking to Lord Srinadeva, saying, you're within all these things. And you are all these things, but you also have your separate existence. This is the understanding of devotion. It permits one to interact with things and maintain one's position of devotion. Just like many of you are going to have, almost all, probably all, we'll have some occupation where you have to interact with things. I don't mean your occupation, just life. Interacting with things. How do you maintain your Krishna consciousness? While interacting with things. Like the example I was giving, in a high pressure situation where you have to interact with things. Or even without the high pressure, just interacting. How do you maintain this understanding that Prahlad's imparting? You'll be glad that you have this understanding, because without it, you'll be stressed out, or you'll be in Maya. You'll be, the spiritual practices that you do that connect you with Krishna, and then there's all this, the rest of this stuff that's just spins your mind. And without a mature, it's not an uncommon position for someone to go through the transitional transit lounge of thinking, gee, I don't know if I want to do this stuff anymore. This just spins my mind. But devotion to Krishna permits one to realize Krishna's presence in those things. And doing those things are practically necessary because we're embodied souls. We need to work because the soul's present in the body, and it animates the body, and the body works. Krishna says it in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Everybody has to perform some type of work. You can't avoid the reactions to work by not working. Because the soul exists, and the soul is animate. The soul is going to animate the body. You have to do some work. So that's not a solution. Do nothing. Sit and do nothing. It's not a solution. The soul is active. So, be active with the understanding that Krishna is present in all things, yet at the same time he maintains his separateness. So you can worship Krishna in his deity form, and in his name form, and in his scripture form, and his prasadam form. You can worship Krishna in his, the various forms of direct devotional activity, and one can worship Krishna in practical activity because he's there. And he's realized, the realization of him is accessible through devotion, acting practically in senses, sense objects, interacting. That's practical. In the mood of devotion, offering that to Krishna. That's the art of living. Prabhupada quotes in the purport, tishtami narada yatra gayanti mad bhaktaha. The Supreme Lord stays, that is, He manifests to our consciousness His presence. He stays only where His devotees chant His glories. So along with those practical activities that we do, this mindfulness of Krishna has to stay. Then thought of Krishna will stay. That the activities of glorifying Krishna through our work and through our words, then thought of Krishna will remain and consciousness of Krishna's presence everywhere will be there. Text 49. Neither the three modes of material nature, nor the predominating deities controlling these modes, nor the five gross elements, nor the mind, nor the demigods, nor the human beings can understand your lordship. For they are subjected to birth and annihilation. I'm going to come back and analyze the logic of that. Considering this, the spiritually advanced have taken to devotional service. Such wise men hardly bother with Vedic study. Instead, they engage themselves in practical devotional service. Now, we study the Vedas, here we are, studying Srimad Bhagavatam. But it's not, what Prahlad is saying, is not that assiduous kind of study where you just lock yourself up in a room and block out the world and just study the Vedas and merge with Brahman as a result, because you just blocked everything out. But that knowledge, the hearing of transcendental knowledge side by side with the practical activities of devotional service, cultivating them both side by side, that's different than this other that I characterized. Karma sannyas, the term is used. That's what Arjuna wanted to do. Let me give up my duty, and I'll just go into a secluded place and not be bothered by the reactions to my duty as a Kshatriya. I'll give up my duty as a Kshatriya. And I'll just meditate. So then I'll be freed from the reactions of killing all these people. Krishna's reply is, for neglect of your duty, you'll get a reaction. But if you engage in your duty, you won't get a reaction. So engage in your duty. You won't get a sinful reaction, I should say. And ultimately, if one dedicates those duties to the Supreme, then liberation comes. That's one of the statements that Prahlad made in text 46, that by following the Varnashram Dharma, dedicated to the Supreme Lord Vishnu, this is the means of liberation. That topic was discussed by Lord Chaitanya in Chaitanya Charitamrita when Lord Chaitanya visited Udupi, just like many of you have visited Udupi. Probably will do so again in May. In Udupi, this idea of following Varnashram Dharma with the dedication of those duties to Vishnu, the goal of which is liberation, that's their chief idea. You can read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Lord Chaitanya heard that, he said, higher is attaining love of God, whether you achieve liberation, go back to Vaikuntha or not. If you achieve love of God, then svarga apavarga narakeshu apituyarta darshanam. This Narayana Parayana position is the ultimate goal, not achieving one's own liberation, but achieving absolute shelter in loving service of the Supreme Lord. That's the message of the Bhagavatam. That's what Lord Chaitanya replied to the followers of Madhvacharya in Udupi. That's our Bhagavatam lesson, is following the footsteps of Narada and Prahlad, Vyasadeva and Shukadeva Goswami. Achieving prema pumartho maha, prema prayojana, achieving love, loving devotion for the personality of Godhead. This is the objective, the ultimate objective of everything that we're doing. Prayojana, ultimate goal. So I said that there's a particular part of the verse which we'll try to explain the logic of. Prahlad is saying that in all of these existences where the Supreme Lord is present, the mind, intelligence, the demigods, modes of nature, predominating deities, human beings, everything, that it's through these things or through these personalities alone they can't understand you. Why? Because they're subject to creation and annihilation. The same idea that is presented by Prahlad is in Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, just preceding the chapter Shloki verses. So if some of you can recall, beginning verses of the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, nobody knows you. The demigods do not know you. The rishis do not know you. Nobody knows you. Why is it that they don't know? Because they're to know Krishna means to know what existed before I existed. Now, how can you know what existed before you existed? You have no experience of it. Because it existed before you do. And you're also going to go out of existence, this body. And your demigod position and rishi position is going to go out of existence and take on another existence. Because what you are is Brahman. And the Supreme Brahman is the support and rest of Brahman. Living entities are based on the prior existence or the existential prior existence of the Supreme Cause. So it's not possible for rishis and devatas to know any more than it's possible for modern science to know what's the cause. They can propose, it was a Big Bang. How do you know? Well, we see the universe is expanding. It's inference. By inference, they know, not because they were there and they saw the explosion. The universe seems to be expanding, and you, by logic, you can say, as it's expanding, the trajectories are moving parts in a further and further away, so you go back in time, and originally was one chunk before it started expanding. But what caused the chunk to start expanding? Well, there was an explosion. Well, how do you account for order in the universe? Chance. You've heard that one before, right? So, but the logic is a very simple thing. Take a bunch of bags of cement, some nails, and some wood. Stick a dynamite, push the plunger, here's the IIT campus. The city of Delhi. That's as far as you want to go. Even just one building. We'll be satisfied with one building. Try it. Well, we do it enough times, we'll get one. The laws of probability are there that we may not get it the first time, the first million, trillion, billion, quadrillion, however. But one of those times, eventually we're going to get. Big bang here. And even if you can get a building out of so many tries, who pushed the plunger? And where do the ingredients come from? never mind, the ingredients are primordial, and there was no plunge. It was just another freak of circumstance, another accident in the universe. Anyway. So, what Prahlad is saying is, none of these people and facilities and processes can realize you by devotion alone. That these deep things that he's explaining can be accessed. And it's not necessary that you just close your eyes and say, I believe. In fact, that won't give you that realization. You may be able to recite. So, there's another very important verse that comes next. I'm way over time, but I beg your indulgence because these ideas are connected. Text 50. Prahlad says, therefore, so that's a key word. It's a summary statement. Therefore, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, best of all persons, to whom prayers are offered, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, because without rendering six kinds of devotional service unto you, so he lists offering prayers, dedicating all results of activities, worshipping you, working on your behalf, always remembering your lotus feet and hearing about your glories, who can achieve that which is meant for the Paramahamsas? So Prahlad is speaking about realization of Paramahamsas, but he's also speaking about the process. Just ordinary vimudha personalities that he's greatly compassionate upon to come to that realization. He's got a big stretch from people that are right at the bottom to people that are right at the top. And he wants to see persons at the bottom come to the top. He's giving the means. And the progressive realizations. It's really fantastic. All glories to Prahlad Maharaj. So, in the purport, in the verse, he's speaking about, Prahlad's speaking about six essential processes of devotional service. In the purport, Prabhupada's giving a wonderful clarification. I'll just read it. Only by the grace of the Supreme Lord can one understand him. The process of understanding the Lord, therefore, is bhakti. Without bhakti, simply by following the Vedic injunctions, to understand the absolute truth will not be helpful at all. He says, one cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead simply by studying the Vedas and offering prayers. Within these six kinds of things, it's offering prayers. Now, I just received a mail yesterday from someone who was asking the question. They had some wonderful realization. I'll just give this one example and I'll be quiet. I can't help it. Prahlad's teachings really kept me going. they were asking a question about prayer. Actually, they had taken a New Year's vrata. They were going to every day conscientiously improve their chanting. And they've been maintaining that since the turn of the year. But periodically they find that try and try and try, it's even difficult just to pronounce the words to the point where they're in tears. They're really trying. So they stopped chanting, read some inspirational words on chanting, went before their deity and offered a prayer. If you so desire, you please help me in maintaining and upholding this vow that I've taken just to please you and my spiritual master. Then they went back to chanting, and it was a whole other experience. So they wanted me to elaborate on the significance of prayer. Here it is. The prayer, in and of itself, is not just the recitation of a prayer and There you did it. Like a vending machine. The deity is not a vent you put in your quarters, or here, you put in your rupees, and you see the item that you want. You have vending machines here on campus selling sodas and candy and things like that. Put in the required number of coins, select your thing, pull the little lever, and out comes the what you want. Unless they're out of stock. Which sometimes happens. So, prayer to Krishna is not a vending machine procedure. The prayer per se is not what invokes the dispensing of what you want. It's the devotion. It's the what this devotee was describing, the sense of dependence. And then coming in that mood of dependence upon the supreme, merciful personality, requesting that which they're ready to deliver anyway. So that the lesson the devotee learned was on the strength of my own. And this is, you know, when they hear this recording, they'll know it's who I'm addressing. This is one of their particular personal obstacles in the path of devotion that, like many of you, have probably learned very well. Try very hard to succeed. This, you know, the academic mindset. Go for it. Work hard. Apply yourself. How many times did you hear that in the course of growing up? Right? Surprise, there's not laughters of comic relief, because I'm sure you've heard it over and over and over again. You're good. You can do it. Go do it. Keep. Pursue that carrot. Go for it. I know you can get that carrot. Keep going. Try harder. On the strength, you're very intelligent. Keep your determination. Don't get distracted. You'll achieve the rewards in the course of your life, you'll see. So this devotee was trying that same process with bhakti and finding it's not working. What's wrong? It's not working. I'm helpless. Please, Krishna. And Krishna's reciprocation was immediate. The process of realizing Krishna is the strength of devotion. And these channels, these six things that are mentioned, they're the mediums of devotional service, but the ingredient is the devotion itself. Like chanting, like praying, like worshiping, like hearing the scriptural message. It's not just that you've all assembled here and that's the, you know, the payment you have to make to Krishna to get your perks, to get your, you know, the things you want. It's the genuine devotion that counts. And this is the vehicle for that. What's supposed to be taking place is a transformation of heart, an awakening of real feelings of devotion. Number one question I'm asked when traveling as a sannyasi is, when will that real feeling of devotion come in my life? I'm doing this, this, and this, but I want... the thing that Prahlad is saying about these other processes, one of the principal defects is that one becomes proud. That's why I addressed the particular point that I made this morning, that you as a group must be very compassionate upon newcomers. And because the opposite is... I'm senior. You sit in the back. I'm going to sit. Anyway, you get the idea. It's just material conditioning. I'm an IIT student. And I'm going to do my PhD here, too. Maybe I'll go abroad. Anyway, I'm exaggerating, but those features are just the opposite features. excel, do wonderfully, be in the mood, be in the right mood in doing those things. One more time. This is part two. We rock part two. Less of their potential strength unless they're connected to bhakti. And the bhakti process finds them already as a subset, already included, and thus empowers them to give their full strength, full capacity or potential. I'll give an example of how the bhakti process can empower one of these 10 principles. I'll give a couple of examples. I know a devotee that works in a high-pressure office situation, and they, with consultation, they decided they wanted to observe the effectiveness of Mauna Vrata. So in their very, very busy office, they selected an hour that would be a reasonable time in their workplace, and they would observe silence. Now, they couldn't practically just say nothing. Somebody came, their superior, the boss came and said, "Did you finish that report yet?" They can't, you know, hold up a flashcard and say, "You know, I'm observing my hour of silence. Please ask me at 2:00. But in other words, they conducted practical activity, but they were conscious specifically during that hour, no wagging of the tongue, no just casual blah, blah, blah stuff. They would, the realization of doing that over a period of several months was that hour was filled with thought of Krishna by controlling the tongue. Mona. It brought thought of Krishna very strongly, not just, you know, "Ooh, this hurts," kind of austerity, but by controlling the tongue, automatically, thoughts of Krishna during that specifically during that period of time strengthened automatically, because they were dedicating that vow of silence to Krishna. Let me just speak about Krishna, even in the workplace, or speak for Krishna and nothing else. No uncontrolled tongue activity. It gave them the realization of exactly what I just explained, that this liberating activity was given full spiritual strength to realize mindfulness of Krishna through that activity. And naturally, it spilled over through the other hours of the day, other wakeful hours of the day. Not speak frivolously, or just gibberishly, or mindlessly, casually, but meaningful speech based on a mind that's compact in thought upon Krishna, that's spread throughout the day. As far as I know, to this day, that this devotee is continuing that same practice. Who knows, maybe they went from 1 hour to maybe another hour during their work day. It's not that one has to do that, but it's just an example of someone that did that and found spiritual empowerment from doing that. So it also helped them understand, I'm just so conditioned to talk and talk and talk and needlessly talk in unproductive, mindless ways all the time. So it's good to control the tongue. Very good practice. I want that mindfulness concentration upon Krishna and the feelings of devotion right there in the office, in the workplace. High pressure job. I assure you, high pressure job. So then another example is vows. We can just take the four principles, the four regular principles, or say initiation vows, or marriage vows, or Ekadasi Vrata vows, or Kartik Vrata vows, or people make these all New Year's resolutions. Anybody here make any New Year's resolutions in January? Well, I did. And maintaining those vows, it's one of the dividing points between unsteady or anishtata bhakti and nishtha, is being able to make vows and uphold and maintain those vows. It's a Vaishnava principle. Making vows and sticking to them. Making vows and not sticking to them, that's not a Vaishnava principle. That's an everyday thing. I'm going to be good. Or I'm not going to eat sweets. Or I'm not going to eat after 6 o'clock. Or, there's a number of them. Making a vow that's productive for increasing one's devotion, that's good. Not maintaining that vow, that's not so good. It actually weakens one's devotion. Better to make vows that you keep than to make vows that you don't keep. Make vows that you keep. Make a vow and keep the vow. That's what vows are for, to be kept. And one who does, one who very seriously makes such a vow, be assured the vow will be tested because we have conditioned tendency. And then the conditioned tendency comes in, just like the tide comes in, and it tends to cover that marginal living entity. Just like the place between where the tide is fully out and the tide is fully in, that in-between space tends to get covered when the tide comes in. So making a vow means I'm not going to get covered when the tide comes in. It's my vow. I know that the tide's going to come in. The tendency to not do this particular thing, or the tendency to neglect doing the thing that I know I should do, is going to happen. But before Krishna and for the pleasure of Krishna and the spiritual master, I'm going to maintain this vow. Then when that is done successfully, then one progresses in spiritual life. And what one's realization, we're going to read about that in the verses for this morning, is the flow of Krishna's mercy is what allows you, not just your determination to hold back the onslaught, because tide will overcome. It'll keep coming. Conditioned tendencies keep coming. They don't stop. The tide doesn't stop because you said, I want you to stop. The tide doesn't stop. So, the second point is that these 10 processes of liberation are not fully effective at their strength is limited. But on the other hand, with the bhakti process, they're a subset of the bhakti process, and their full strength is then realized. So one may or may not do each and every one of them, and one's success is not dependent upon each and every one of them. But one's devotion is the criterion for success, and applying those things in the mood of devotion is the criterion for their full success. Bhakti is independent, and they're dependent. That's part two. In part three, the third essential message of the Bhagavatam slokas that we read last night is in text 47, Prahlad says, it's by the bhakti process that the inextricable oneness of you and all things is fully realized, whereas by these other processes, it's not fully realized. That liberation, therefore, is incomplete. Or the material tendency can again creep in. The conditioned tendency, the agham tendency, can again enter. Acting according to the modes of nature can again enter. But with the realization of the mature stage of devotion is manifest, one can fully realize the absolute position of you present in all things. What was the example that he gave? The wood and fire example? Somebody can remember that besides wood and fire? Any bells ringing? Yes.
So, everything is like, although we cannot perceive him, it's like,
yeah, that's an example, right. So, through the process of Gyan, theoretically we can understand. But if the mind becomes disturbed, there goes the Gyan. And we forget the absolute nature of the Supreme within all things. But through the bhakti process, because it's sustained by the natural quality of the soul through love of the Supreme, then that realization comes and sustains. That's the indication. And it's not accessible otherwise. Obviously it's not accessible otherwise because the personality of Godhead, is realizable only through devotion. So presence of the personality of Godhead, the original cause of even Brahman, or to speak of what comes from Brahman, that all material and spiritual existence coming from Brahman. Krishna is Brahmano hi pratishtaham. He's the basis and support of that. Bhagavad Gita chapter 14. So, it's not realized except through his personal existence is not realized except through a personal process of loving service. Prabhupada gives he gives two references to support this idea. Bhaktyamam abhijanati, as found in Bhagavad Gita. What's the meaning? Bhaktyamam abhijanati. What's the meaning? Yes. Only what? Only by devotional service. Then what? Yeah, okay. Krishna is known by that process of bhakti only. Bhaktyam abhijanati. From Bhagavad Gita. And in the purport here, Prabhupada quotes a statement in the Uddhava Gita, in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. It's not so often quoted, but it's saying exactly the same thing. So it's a nice quote to know. Bhaktyaham, Krishna speaking, first person, singular, aham. Bhaktyaham, ekaya, graya. I am only understood by the process of bhakti, and not otherwise. Eka, by this one process alone, am I understood as the original cause of all causes. So that understanding, Prahlad is making it very clear, it's not just a conceptual one or theoretical one. It's a practical one. And practical realizations require practical activity. The practical activity of taking your senses to sense objects and interacting with them in the mode of devotion. Then Krishna's presence becomes disclosed in a realized way when the mood of devotion is there. And not otherwise. That's bhaktyaham ekaya graya, or bhaktyamam abhijanati. That's what Prahlad is saying. Giving the example of fire and wood, or the subtle, it's a theme that he's developing. Subtle cause is present within the gross manifestation. There's this inextricable oneness. Okay? Those are the 3 points from yesterday evening's verses. Now, just thinking about how to do this review this morning, I'll just share my thoughts with you. This is a different group than the evening group, especially on Saturday night, because it's a Saturday night feast and it's kind of a festive occasion, and it's very nice prasadam. Many other people come that aren't here Monday through Friday morning. So, I presented the main points out of what Prahlad had to say in a different way than I did last night. Why? Different group, different audience. Any speaker, public speaker or educator, it's a rule. You have to know your audience. Just like I gave the example of teaching lessons to children. You can't teach a lesson to a child in the same exact way you teach to an adult. The same principles may be passed on, but you have to address your audience appropriately. So, this morning I've gone through in a very focused 1, 2, 3 way, so it will stick, hopefully. If tomorrow morning I ask what were the 3 points, hopefully you'll be able to explain them. More than explain them, hopefully you'll internalize them. And by exercising that, recalling to your memory and carrying those thoughts with you in the course of your devotional life, it may make some meaning. Hopefully it'll make some meaning. But so it's a different group. And so the thought that I had was that Prahlad, in his prayers to Lord Nrisimhadev, he's exercising an extreme degree of compassion. He wants that all persons come to that same realization. He knows the method, devotional service. He knows that devotional service also needs to be empowered by the Lord's mercy through the medium of merciful representative of the Lord. He wants that for himself, and he wants that for everyone. So, this morning group, it's a more, I guess, how to exactly characterize, but basically, a more experienced group. There's some more dedication or commitment coming to come here 4 o'clock in the morning for Mangal Arati. That's and then come again at 6 o'clock for deity greeting and morning class. That's a very nice, very very nice commitment, and the benefit. The reward will be yours. But then there's so many other people. So like Prahlad, we should have compassion for so many other people. And we don't need to be fanatical or forceful or, over the top in that concern. But at least it's something that should be carried in your heart. Now, there's a particular point that I wanted to make with all of this, and that is, there's a tendency for being more compassionate to outsiders than, let's say, to newcomers. I've seen this. Maybe this is a different group of individuals. But those persons who are newly coming just to hear and understand and experience, get some sense of what this is all about. Even more important is to show Prahlad-like compassion to those persons. Then those persons who are not at all participating. And we have many endeavors through book distribution and different ways of giving compassionate association or Krishna's mercy to others. But what's really the mark of genuine compassion is that those who are, how to say this properly, kind of care and concern and attention that you would have wanted to have, what you would have wanted to experience when you first came in contact was, is what we should provide for those people. When I was in Mayapur recently, I heard for the first time the story of Brajabihari. Maybe some of you know Brajabihari. He's the headmaster of the Gurukul in Vrindavan. So, there were two things that really helped him initially become a devotee. One of them was, he narrated this to Bhadri Narayan, who was the temple president. Bhadri Narayan is a very strong person. I mean, not physically strong, but just character-wise, a very strong person. And he was the temple president in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There was a center connected with the university. University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He was temple president. So they were sitting next to each other, prasadam, and having this discussion. And Bhadri Narayan was complimenting Brajabihari. You know, from the first day that you came, I could see right away that you're a devotee. He said, you don't know what it took to come to the temple for the first time. He said, because the temple was some distance from the campus, so he had to walk to the campus. And he said he walked towards the door and then turned around and walked away. And then he made another pass and just walked past the place. Then he walked past again. And then he went to some park and sat down. And then some devotee saw him sitting in the park. Said, why don't you come with me? You're planning to come to the temple? Come on, let's go. And because the devotee was so warm and accommodating and friendly, and when he came, he felt, I'm here at last. But I've heard similar descriptions from other people that it took them, you know, 20 times, of planning to go to the temple and just keep walking past the temple before they finally went in. So someone who just first time comes, that's major. Not just the first time they come, but, you know, getting in the transit lounge position, you know, just, what's this? So that there needs to be very much Prahlad-like compassion from those of you that are a little more experienced in all of this towards those who are just beginning and getting tested in ways that all of you got tested. What about this? And what about that? And peer pressure? And da 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 da. So many things. So many grosser forms of conditioning, and even some of the subtler forms of conditioning are encountered. So, it's very important service for all of you to be very compassionate. And not for sentimental reasons or, you know, building up our us and them mentality, strength, but for the right spiritual reasons, because this process, the same reasons that Prahlad is giving, this process of devotion can bring one to the position of real happiness. However one takes it, however one applies it, it's the antidote for the material condition of life. So at least to give those persons a loving and kind, warm reception and treatment and ask them how they're doing as they're going along. Very important. The compassionate quality of a devotee of the Lord is so attractive and so necessary for the process of bhakti to be traversed by souls that are coming out of the material condition of life and looking at a spiritual way of life. The sangha, sadhu sangha atmosphere, very much required, and that has to come from everyone here. Each of us has some responsibility like that, just like in the bigger picture of the world, we have a responsibility to act in a Vaishnava-like way. Like I was giving that example of Mahasringa in his business pursuits. He has to be an exemplary Vaishnava. Or any one of you, when you go off in your careers and into your family life and whatever you're going to do, those things that you have a responsibility. You have a spiritual responsibility to society to act in a Vaishnava-like way. And here there's a bit of a sangha of practitioners. So the point is clear. Amongst yourselves, and this is a Madhyama Adhikari position, those that are less advanced and innocent, be compassionate. Think of Prahlad. Be compassionate. So, now a little overview of, it's already 7:30, a little overview of what the verses we're going to discuss this morning. Prahlad is carrying this Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma idea. Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. Somebody knows the meaning? Yes. Everything is Brahma. Right. Sarvam literally means matter and spirit. Same term is used in Bhagavad Gita. What's the first of the Chaturshloki verses of Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavad Gita, Chaturshloki verses. Yeah. Okay. Aham sarvasya prabhava. There it is again, sarva. Everything, matter and spirit. Sarva means all. So matter, from eighth chapter, from the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's indicated this material world is made up of these two kinds of prakritis. Vina prakritir ashtada and para prakriti. So matter and spirit. So sarvasya, aham sarvasya prabhava. Means, comes into being, is made manifest. Krishna is the source, the prabhava, manifesting source of everything, which is sarvam kalvidam brahma. Same idea. So he's speaking, Prahlad is emphasizing the oneness. These next few verses, the oneness feature, this realization of the fire in the wood, or the realization of the Supreme Lord's presence in everything. He gets into details this time. He gets into like a little inventory list of the ways in which the Lord has manifested himself in the creation. And then he again repeats how That's realized by the process of devotion. It's not a new idea, he's just expanding something that he's already said more succinctly. Just like